kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 106, with me, Doug Belshaw, and...
me, Di Barnes. Hello, Doug.
How are you doing, Di?
I'm very well. I'm still in Idaho. I've changed locations, so I might not have as much traffic noise. Worked out how, using a Nest system, how to turn the air conditioning off so it doesn't rumble in the background behind me, and hopefully we should be all right.
Happy days. So this is like a home automation thing?
Yeah, the Nest thing is quite cool. I've never seen it before. So Gillian Laurie are sort of into it. And they've got three different little Echo devices around the house that control all the lights. And they have a Nest as well. So they're obviously subscribing to that that world of the automated home, you know.
So the Nest, like thermostat thing?
Yeah.
That's not a subscription thing. I've got one of those in my house.
Yeah. They're good, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, obviously, mine doesn't control air conditioning because that would work for 3 days a year. But I have to say, it stopped. I think we've talked about this before, but it stopped a lot of arguments between my wife and I in terms of what temperature the house should be, because you just decide, hey, it's going to be, like, I think we agreed that 19 or 20, and then the heating kicks in when it needs to, and it learns your patterns, like when you're out and all this kind of stuff. It's great.
What else do I like? I like the dial thing. It took me a while when I was turning it off, because I don't have the app on my phone, obviously, it to work out that it had a dial around the edge. I had no idea. I was like pushing, and then it, so it's quite a good design.
That Airbnb I stayed at with Martin Dougiamis in Highbury in London during the Moodle Net Design Sprint, that had a Nest. Like the guy who was worked, he was a single guy who had that apartment. And he had all the kids. Like, he had a Nest in every room.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, you could have every room a different temperature.
Oh, I see. That's why he had one in every room. Mm. Why would you want to do that?
Well, I can understand why you'd want your bedroom a different temperature to your lounge.
Well, yes.
Possibly. Yeah, I guess the rest of it's just overkill.
I thought, well...
Now, this is a guy who had a projector above his bed, so whatever.
What, to play movies while he's in bed?
Yeah.
One assumes. Okay. I'd avoid that kind of thing. But I think it's, the Nest system, I think, is good. So I think I'd get it if I was setting up home, probably.
Yeah, I think, applying it to our house. So our house actually didn't have a thermostat before we put one in. So obviously it wasn't just getting the Nest, it was getting a thermostat as well, which was a huge deal. Our house was built about 1871. So putting in like zonal underfloor heating, like this guy had, to be able to have different temperatures in different rooms, just isn't really possible. But it's a good thing, and I definitely have one in any house I had.
Yeah, no, definitely good.
So you're still enjoying Idaho?
Yes, Idaho's been great. It's a bit of an odd, it's not really a holiday. I'm just here for a month living with my friends, really. Mm. And so they go off to work and I get up to my own thing. So I've been doing the same sort of thing, more yoga, more running, more swimming. And then they come home and we drink and go out. So what things have been going on? So I went to see Friday night, maybe, or Saturday night, possibly. I can't remember. We went to Sockeye Microbrewery. So there's loads of microbreweries here. It's just quite interesting. I don't think I talked about this last week. So I've been going to, I've gone to about half a dozen of those maybe. And this one was called Sockeye. And friends of Laurie's, who she's in a band with, were playing there in another band. And then they invited her on stage to do one of the songs to sort of highlight this new band called Tekosha. Mm-hmm. Playing Trouble in Your Mind. So I videoed that and she's put it up on YouTube. So there's a link to that in the show notes if you'd like to see Laurie smashing her banjo. It's it's really good. So that was an awesome night. Got to meet their friends, new people, all of that kind of thing. Really lovely. And then at home when I'm in the day, I filmed Peanut the Hummingbird. So there's a hummingbird that comes and visits a little dish of sugar water that Gilly makes up, special sugar that you use for hummingbirds. And the hummingbird comes up and dips its long beak into the holes and sucks up some sugar water. So there's a little video of that I put on Instagram, which I've linked to in the show notes. What else have I been doing? Oh, the other thing I've been doing is, so Gilly said, he says, are you any good at computer games? And I said, all right, more or less. What are you talking about? And he said, I'm stuck on Lara Croft. I can't kill the bear. And so I've been playing Tomb Raider. I think it's called Tomb Raider Rise or Rise of the Tomb Raider or something from 2016, I think the title is. And that's been like so much fun getting back into a computer game, which I haven't done.
On which device was this?
He's got an Xbox that he inherited from Laurie's brother, who works for Google, Logan Evans, who I've talked about before. Mm. So I think it's the original Xbox. I haven't really looked at it in detail. It looks a bit old and it's very slow to load stuff, I have to say. Very frustrating. But it's all played online rather than with discs, which I guess is the way things are done these days. That's how
long. Well, the original Xbox wouldn't have done that. So it must be, it must be like 360.
It could be. It must be that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. So Lara Croft, I kind of knew what the score would be, but it's interesting. So now playing computer games, I know so much more about computer science and programming. So it's watching the algorithms at work and how they get them and how clever the gameplay is. And I think with the Lara Croft one, it's quite a simple gameplay and set of controls and things like that. But equally, that simplicity means that it doesn't have much sophistication in the gameplay, I think. But it's quite easy to do and it's quite nice to play. So we finished that title, and then he had some others that he'd bought, and one of them was Assassin's Creed Unity, and which he had done 2% of, because he just says, I just couldn't get into it. It was just really boring. And what I found was, so I went and had a look at it, and then I had to play quite a long chunk of very boring material to get past the sort of introductory thing before the assassin became part of the Assassin's Creed. And then it gets a little bit more interesting. But still, the gameplay is quite slow. It's a bit like Grand Theft Auto or something, you know, when you're in a beautiful, beautiful Paris in the 1870s, and it's really beautifully animated. But the gameplay is like frustrating. It's a little bit slow. It's a little bit annoying. Just roll around and do what you like. You climb. You do this fantastic sort of free running up and down buildings all over Paris and across the room and all that. But you find the controls just click into that automatically, and it's really, really annoying. So as you're running along, you hit, you know, you accidentally knock a caravan or something, then you jump on top of it. So it's interesting looking at the gaming in that kind of way again, really. Last one I did like that was called...
It's interesting when you do... I mean, I'm not a computer scientist, but you do start seeing... You start seeing the raw mechanics of the game after a while, don't you? And I think at that point, it's almost like Keanu Reeves seeing The Matrix. Like, you see the game for what it really is. Yeah, never mind the cool graphics or whatever. Like, you see beyond there to the game mechanics. And it gets to that stage for me with every version of FIFA, especially. So, for example, the current FIFA 18, which I play a lot of now, has got the same game engine as FIFA 17. It's just got basically different graphics and stuff. It's the Frostbite game engine. And you start recognizing not only the fact that, okay, after a while you get used to FIFA and the game mechanics of that, but you also get used to the game engine underneath it and what's possible to do.
Oh, yeah, no, that is exactly it. So it's like the skeleton of the game starts to reveal itself. And the... it becomes less interesting. But one of the things I've noticed is I find it really hard to put down. So once you start playing, you could just be there for hours and hours and hours. So even though you're playing and you feel like fed up and bored because you're trying to get past a section and get the combinations just right, you just keep on going and keep on going. Anyway, you finished Lara Croft and I've given up on Assassin's Creed, and I think we're going to buy the next Lara Croft. Or no, there's one called Definitive, Lara Croft Definitive. I think we're going to get that, which is an older version, but very, very good, apparently.
Okay.
So we're going to...
Well, like I said last week, I put loads of Nintendo 64 and Super Nintendo games on the NVIDIA Shield that I've got. So this week I've been playing more of those. And Mario Tennis is absolutely fantastic. If you just want to pick up a quick game, like you've got 5 minutes, quick game of Mario Tennis is just the best. It really is.
That's what you want. I remember playing. We had a Nintendo thing and a Wii one, and playing Mario Kart on that. Wow, what a game that is!
Mm.
Because it's just literally that. It's good for like half an hour, and then you get bored. And but
well, when we got the Shield, we gave the original Wii, not the Wii U, to my parents. But you know, my kids occasionally played over at their house. But I think we're going to get that back. And it's also made me think: is £270 too much for a Switch? Maybe I should get one. Maybe I should get one before we go on holiday next week and take it with us. But then you look at the games, and the games are like £40 for like a Mario game. You think,
Oh yeah, I meant to say, you know, I was talking about gaming last week to do the digital detox. Some research came up, and I think $36 billion in a year has been spent in the last year has been spent on gaming in America alone on hardware and software. Massive, massive industry.
Well, the budgets for some of the AAA titles that the biggest games companies are creating, the budgets for those are larger than film budgets.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I noticed the new Lara Croft, which goes with the film that was released this year, I think, is $60 pre-order. You can.
It was the pre-orders come out for FIFA 19. Mm. And the standard version is $59.99. And the one that Ben wants, obviously, is $79.99. The most expensive one is £90. And wow. Some of the games like Battlefront, the most expensive version of that was over £100 when it came out.
Oh my gosh, I did notice actually that, what's it called? Fortnite was in there, and Battle Royale is free. But there are versions that you can get, which were £85. I was like, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money.
Well, the thing is, if you pay up front for, the things that you're basically paying up front, which is cheaper for in-game purchases, which then gives you an advantage when you start the game. And like with anything, if you've got an advantage at the start, then you can, and you keep playing it, then you've got an advantage later on. Interestingly, Ben came home from athletics camp today, talking about Twitch, which he's never talked about before.
Okay.
We talked about Twitch a couple of times, but he didn't really know what it was. He kind of picked up that it was like a thing that you'd watch other people game. But he went on it when he came back, and he was looking. He hasn't got an account or anything. But when he signed up, when he went to look at it, he saw that there's a FIFA World Cup, like a online tournament for all of the e-gamers, which starts tomorrow. And so he's planning to watch some of that tomorrow.
Well, that'd be interesting to see. So I had, not the year that I've just left, but the year before of my of leavers, my students, they were really into their e-gaming, their e-sports. We looked at setting up a sort of e-sports league, but I just don't think I could get it past management. And because they all hate gaming and think it's a waste of time. But now he's at universities in Newcastle, I think, studying computer science, and he is big into their esports leagues, which are quite big at universities, apparently. So he's got a Twitch channel, and he's trying to get a profile in that regard and all that kind of thing, and working on that, because you can make money out of esports now, apparently.
Yeah, well, interestingly, some of the people I follow on Mastodon are streamers, and it's interesting because some of them, like, there are different channels. So there's channels for, like, if you just want to watch lots of FIFA, or if you want to watch lots of Fortnite, there's channels for that, and there's different people playing it. But also people who are like YouTube celebrities, and therefore they play lots of different games, and you kind of, you're watching them because you're interested in them playing the game. And people, it's a bit like Patreon, people donate, like doing that kind of stuff. And also I think, although this starts getting not weird, but into the realms of stuff that on a family-friendly show like us, we're not going to discuss. But, like cam girls, where, you're basically watching somebody do some kind of sexy dance. I understand that you can buy like lingerie for them and send it to them. I think it's the same kind of deal with streamers, in the sense of like they'll wear the crazy hat that you sent them and that kind of stuff.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
That's weird. And that's weird that you can do that, isn't it? I guess some people get really into that stuff, which is why the world is a weird place.
Well, we get this all the time, I guess, on a smaller level. If you met some huge celebrity, I don't know, like Tom Cruise or Kim Kardashian or something, someone like that, you get that kind of like awestruckness of like, I've seen you in films. But I don't think I'm the only one who get some of that when you see somebody who is not that famous, but like has quite a few followers and you've seen them on YouTube or something like that, and then you see them in real life. I got that, for example, when I saw Carrie-Anne Philbin for the first time at BET after seeing her on YouTube on the Geek Girl Diaries and things.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, well, you get a little bit of that, don't you? I guess it depends where your mojo's at, isn't it? Maybe.
Like, if you think that person's awesome and you see them like do stuff on the screen, and it's not that you've got a relationship with them any more than you've got a relationship with someone who's in a film, but then you see them in real life, it's like, how do I react to them? It's a weird thing.
I think, I mean, YouTube,
Twitch in the show notes. The other thing I want to mention, just to start off with, I just knocked the microphone, is hi, Elan Ezekiel, if you're listening. Elan put on Twitter today, I think, that, so we're recording this on the 1st of August, Wednesday the 1st of August. Elan put 3 emoji after his username, which led to a Twitter conversation. Did you see that?
I did see that, yes. I was part of that conversation. yes. And it's an interesting thing, isn't it? The idea that you can... so what's Elan added? I can't remember what it is.
So he's added like a little fist like mine. He's put a tree, and then he's got like almost the Dr. Spock, like parting your fingers in the middle there, that little sign.
All right, yes, which makes sense. He loves his sci-fi.
And hilariously, Amy Bavall's put, you're so much more than 3 mirror emoji, Elan.
So she has. And then there's the...
Cool. Well, Alex Bellas comes in, and Alex says he used to have lots of emoji in his username, and then he was told that it made life difficult for Twitter users who need to use a screen reader, and he links to an article about that on CBC, which is a Canadian broadcaster. Elan replies that the article suggests that 3 emoji is acceptable. So it's good to know that the 3 emoji thing is you know, still an acceptable thing to do, even from an accessibility point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Elan says that he's put his in as, where's it gone? There are 3 things. One is, his emojis represent the struggle, the inheritance, and the geek.
Very good.
Cool.
Yes, I like that. And actually, that takes us to... I'll just do my bit first here. This week is all about doing the... So I'm off on holiday next Tuesday, and we're working on UX Milestone 2 on MoodleNet, like I was talking about last time. Mm-hmm. Now, last time we talked, I was dealing with Matt and Kaylee at Outlandish, who are both fantastic, and Matt is kind of is the head of UX there. Now, we knew this was going to happen, but his partner, after I talked to him on Friday afternoon, a few minutes after talking to him, his partner's waters broke, and he is now a proud father. And so this week, I've had to deal with Rob, who is standing in for Matt and is doing a fantastic job, I have to say. So I'm working with him on UX Milestone 2 and doing 4 screencasts, 2 of which are already out. One came out on Tuesday, and one came out today on Wednesday. And so there's 2 more to do on those. And it's been interesting because I've been putting them out and seeing what people's reactions are and just also where people choose to put their comments. Some people, like Adam Proctor, put theirs on the MoodleNet blog. Some people put them on YouTube. Some people put them on social networks like Twitter. Some people put them in the forum. Some people prefer to email me directly. So it's been interesting to get that kind of feedback. The first screencast, which you can see in the show notes, is all about just the workflow for adding a resource. And my hope for this was that it looked super simple. Like it looked like, well, obviously this is how you'd add a resource in MoodleNet. And that's largely been the reaction with a few caveats about like, have you thought about this and that, et cetera. But that was the first one. And then the second one, which kind of went out today, is all about the idea of having an alt profile, an alternative profile. So you can switch between you as Di Barnes, for example, and then you with a pseudonym, and you could reply under that. And there's been some interesting comments there because people like Oliver Quinlan, for example, hi, Oliver, he was saying, well, alt sounds a bit like alt-right and sounds a bit wrong in the kind of current political climate. So I hadn't thought about that. That was a useful kind of bit of feedback. And then I don't have you seen these? I'm not, there's no reason why you would have done that.
I haven't seen the screencast yet. No, I haven't looked at them. I did see them come through, but you know, I'm on holiday.
So I asked Oliver, you know, what would be a good name, and he suggested like a ghost profile or something. Peter Phillips said maybe a parallel profile, which I think is pretty useful. And then Tom Kenyon came along and suggested another one as well, although I can't see his reply. I don't know if he's deleted it now. He suggested Twoodle, which was an interesting one. But yeah, I mean, you have to get the names of these features right to make sure it's okay. And then Gayatri Venugopal, who is in Pune in India, said that she couldn't relate to the concept of having an alt profile personally, but it might be beneficial if you want to create a separate identity for a set of communities. My thought was that it would be a B-side. But yeah, I'd be interested in people's thoughts on that.
Well, I think the word alias would be pretty good. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it? As in what you're suggesting, sort of an alias profile?
Yep.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Possibly. Anyway.
I was wondering how many you could not get away with, but how many you'd want. Like, is it enough to have just like one pseudonym, or would you want several? I've tried to imply a context and a reason here without, you know, spelling it out in large neon letters, but in this particular screencast you've got Jeremy, who's a, you know, straight-laced teacher according to his profile, but when you go to his alt profile or his alias or his parallel profile or whatever you want to call it, you know, he's his interests are like LGBT rights and radical socialism and PhD research and gender studies. So without spelling it out, I wanted to kind of show that there might be a reason why people sometimes want to have two different facets of themselves.
Yes, yeah, so I think that, yeah, no, I think that's fair play. The only thing is that if you had two facets of yourselves, you wouldn't want them linked, would you? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's only, so, you know, we're talking about the three emoji idea. The two accounts are entirely separate as far as users of the social network are concerned. So you've got three different emoji IDs, and there's no way in which they would be linked. But obviously on the back end, they are linked because you log in with the same username or the same email address or the same credentials. So that, and the benefit of doing that is that if someone's being a dick or trolling people or whatever, we can see who that is and they're not completely anonymous to us.
Of course. Moodle,
or the instance administrator.
Okay. Well, that sounds like it's got mileage. I think you just have to be careful about people associating accounts with each other. But as long as you can't track one person's other accounts through their account, then that would be okay, I'd have thought.
Yeah. So we were careful to do that in the demo and the prototype, because an example of things where, you know, you think, oh, well, how would they possibly link the two? But the idea is in MoodleNet that you are vouched for by somebody in the same way that on mozillions.org, which is the Mozilla directory, you're vouched for. So for example, on my profile, it would say vouched for by Di Barnes, which means that, you know, if I start being a dick, it's not just reflecting on me, it's reflecting on you as well. It's a kind of a check and balance in that regard. But of course, if you then put vouched for by Di Barnes on my profile and my alias, and Di has only vouched for one person, and that's me, then of course you see that must be me. So it's just finding all those little things and kind of plugging the gaps. As with anything, it's the 80-20 rule of the first 80% is easy, and then you spend forever doing like little tweaks and thinking, well, what if this happened, etc.
Yeah, it's the absolute problematic thing in the world is going through all the scenarios.
So yeah, I'm doing that. There's a couple more to do, and they are going to be, I've just done the third one today, which is about a new user called Frankie, and she's going to sign up. Initially, when you sign up, you only have to give a very small amount of information, and then it prompts you, a bit like when LinkedIn says, oh, your profile is 90% complete. It prompts you to complete your profile. And then the last one is potentially the one that adds the most value, but the most problematic to actually record, and that is sending collections of resources from MoodleNet to a Moodle account, a Moodle site.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. It's quite exciting.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying doing it, actually, and I want to make sure that it's completely done. I was talking to Mael de Borneol this morning, who's the technical architect, and he's got a sprint to do by himself, basically, 2 weeks while I'm away. So just like setting everything up so that when I get back, we can crack on. I'm talking to Michael Shaw from Tez Resources tomorrow. They haven't got an API at the moment, but it'll be good to think about how we could, you know, because they've got lots of really good resources, how we can work together more harmoniously rather than just, you know, point to a link which doesn't give you that much information.
So is that, so a lot of the test resources are behind a paywall, though?
Yeah, and not just that. If you want to basically do anything, you have to log in. And so one of the things I want to explore is whether MoodleNet can get some kind of privileged access to as resources to be able to pull some of the data out of there.
Okay, for anyone listening not in the UK, the TES is the Times Educational Supplement, and the Times is a newspaper in the UK, and it's their educational chunk, which is now quite an independent arm of that company, the Times newspaper company, and makes lots of really cool educational resources that teachers shared for free, but they've monetized it in the past a few years, I think. Yeah, we'll see how that goes for them. I don't know if it makes them any money or not.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, this is the thing, like there's a whole rabbit hole to go down here in terms of like OER repositories. Some of them are extremely pure and are funded by foundations and have an API and just let you do whatever you want. Others are like, well, you know, we need to make some money here, so charge for API access. Some just completely cut it off and don't have an API. And I can understand all those positions. It's just that it makes my life more difficult because I have to then go around to the most popular ones and knock on the door and say, hey, we've got 100 million users. Would you like to do a deal?
Yes, indeed. Deals are good.
Yeah. Okay, there's another couple of things I want to talk about. But before I do, I think you've got some things you want to talk about too.
One of the things, so last week I mentioned a synchronization tool or a hookup tool in the back end for Microsoft OneNote and Google Classroom. And I've just been doing some work this morning rather than anything fun, because I just had some things I had to get off my desk, as it were, I tried out this tie-in in the background and set it up, and it was quite difficult. And Miguel Gulen had shared a couple of how-to videos. And interestingly, the first one, he was doing it, and he realized that the system that he'd used before, the method he'd used before, was broken and didn't work anymore due to something to do with one of the two companies. And so he comes back and makes another video, and then it worked using the online version of OneNote, and you were able to connect Google Classroom. And I was thinking, oh, this is okay, done it, brilliant. So I connected it to like a test class and did all of this. And then the only thing it really does, so anything from Google does not transport over to OneNote, only from OneNote Classbook or Class Notebook does it transfer over into Google. So that's all it does is when you make it, I'm assuming you could probably mark it through Google as well. But he didn't go through to that testing, and I can't do that without having pupils, and I don't have test users in Google that I could use. And so then the other part of that brought me to another notification that I received about from Alice Keeler, who is really big into her Google CPD, and she offers courses and things like that, which you can sign up and go to if you'd wish. But her blog, and she's written books on Google Classroom and other Google tools, her blog's really, really helpful. And anyway, she cites some of the new things in Google Classroom that are at play. It's had a bit of a facelift and all that kind of thing, a big change around. So if you are a Google Classroom user, I do recommend getting familiar with those before lessons begin. But also the marking is much improved. So the blog post that I've linked to in the show notes is to the marking, new marking system that they have, which makes it much, much easier. You don't have to open up everything in separate tabs. You can just move to the next pupil. It has rubrics that you can put in for bank.
Yeah, I had a quick look. It looks like there's some kind of menu or overlay in the right hand side over the top of the student's Google Doc, so you have a marking pane down the right hand side.
And I think it's quite interesting. So if you're familiar with using Google Docs, you'll know about all the different add-ons that you can get that other people made, the third party things, and that could just be you or me making them and then sharing them with the world. and you're just using scripts, app scripts, really. But you design it, and you can design the user interface, and a lot of it uses the toolbar down the right-hand side, as you just referred to. And so I think they must have, I've looked at a couple of them that do this comment bank thing, because it's obviously very useful when you have regular errors, recurring errors going on, to highlight them quickly. And just makes your work faster. But and this must have adapted one of those, I think, and Google have taken it on board, and that must be really cool for the people who made it, I guess. But the idea of being able to flick through from one person's work to the next, they've just put some. So what you tend to find is quite an interesting design thing, I think. So with Classroom, they were doing things like putting a green tick on something when it had been done, but now they just gray it out because it's been archived and finished and things like that. They're just changing the way it's set up a little bit and bringing its user interface more in line with other web standards, I guess. I think it looks good. But obviously the devil is in the detail, like the thing that I did with OneNote and Classroom. The detail is until you've used it in anger, you don't really know whether how helpful it's going to be. But I'm optimistic. I hope it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm. No, it's useful. That's definitely useful. Cool.
Yes, and the other thing I've been doing is while I've been here, so because Laurie's been playing her in these bluegrass with all this bluegrass stuff, so I've been getting into bluegrass, and so I've just put a little YouTube video of this song that I'm trying to learn. So it's a very different style of playing to me, running a bass line on my thumb whilst picking with my fingers, and it's not something I'm used to in that way. So I've chosen a song called Sitting on Top of the World by Doc Watson, a famous bluegrass player, and that recording on there is from 1962, although that's not the way I'm playing it, which is I mean, it looks easier what he's doing, but it is I'm learning how to do it from one of his songs, but not that version, I don't think. Anyway, really, it's really cool to be playing bluegrass and playing my guitar in a different way, so I'm doing plenty of that too.
You've also put a link in about a hummingbird as well, on which you've put on Instagram. And I think one of the things that you get from doing the kind of travel that you're doing, which is not just like a quick in and out, but like a month, like being like ensconced in the place, is that you get to see the wildlife. And also, I think you're eating differently as well.
So Gil is vegetarian and Laurie is gluten-free. So I'm eating, Gil is a great cook, and I'm eating lots of vegetarian gluten-free food, which suits me fine. Gluten-free pasta last night was a bit weird, but it wasn't bad in any way. It just wasn't as good as normal pasta, in my opinion. And so all these diets. I just drank today. Have you ever had a cold brewed coffee before?
Yep.
Well, I've never had that before. So I've had a bottle of cold brew coffee, which I thought was particularly unpleasant in the mouth, but quite nice afterwards.
Have you ever made your own cold brew?
I did try once upon a time, I think, in response to something Ian O'Byrne said, that he cold brewed his coffee. So I had a go at it, but I wasn't impressed with what came out the other end.
Well, the thing is, you don't have to keep it. I mean, I'm sure this is heresy to Ian and other people, but you don't actually have to keep it cold. And one of the valuable things about doing it, so cold brew coffee, as it sounds, for those listening, is instead of pouring boiling water onto your coffee grounds, you basically put it in a thing in the fridge, shake it, leave it overnight, shake it again, leave it a bit longer, and then it's not as bitter. It's Cory Doctorow and other people swear by it, and I think they drink it cold. But when I've done it before, which I've only done a couple of times, I've actually heated it up, and it's a different flavor, I have to say.
Oh, okay. Well, that might be... might be worth me pursuing, but there is a need for cold coffee in this country. So it's pretty much 40 degrees centigrade here every day.
Oh, I tell you what I did. You know, when I was at the mountain moot, I quite like matcha. Have you had matcha before?
No.
So matcha comes from the tips of a particular type of matcha plants, etc. And it's supposed to have some of the same. It's got, I don't know if it's caffeine, but it's certainly got some kind of element or chemical in it which gives you energy, but in a kind of more sustained, slow way rather than the kind of jerk that you get from caffeine. Okay. So I put it in smoothies, etc. And you can buy it in Starbucks now as a drink. You can have it cold or hot. Interestingly, I had it in I've had it in the UK before. No, I had it in Berlin. That's right. That's the first time I had it. And when I went in Berlin, they gave it to me for free because they said, I don't think you're going to like this. And this is like Berlin next to that Brandenburg Gate, like the big Starbucks. And they were like, I don't think you're going to like this. I'm going to give it to you for free. I did like it, but it wasn't very sweet. I had it in America, in Montana, and it was super sweet and lovely. And then I had it in Amsterdam on the in the airport on the way back, and it was back to being like a bit harsh and not very sweet. And it just made me think that actually Americans do just sweeten pretty much everything, don't they?
Well, that's one of the things. So the sliced loaf here, so I bought a sliced loaf, and it looks the same as I would buy in England, but it tastes completely different. Mm. And it's a big part of that. And I remember going for sushi as well one day after yoga at this little restaurant on the way home. And beautiful sushi they made, flipping out. I had an iced tea with it, and it was just tea with ice in, which is not what I experienced. That was the only sort of thing that looked remotely full of crap on the menu. And then it was beautiful. And it was quite nice. It was, you know, I guess iced tea is something you would sugar yourself, just like normal tea back in the day. But because you get Lipton iced tea or whatever, you know, the stuff you get in the bottles that my kids used to drink. So I assumed that's what I was going to get.
Right.
But it was just it was a really nice thing to have proper cold tea, just black tea. It's lovely.
Good stuff. Okay, well, another couple of things to get out of the way just before we get into things proper. I have now submitted our MozFest, Mozilla Festival 2018 proposal. That's happening right at the end of October, as it does every year. This particular one is on decentralization and focused on MoodleNet. We're co-conspirators from Outlandish are in there as well. So potentially thinking about things from a sociocratic point of view, using the theory of sociocracy. They're going to submit a separate one on how to run kind of your business or a design sprint using sociocratic principles. So the two are kind of inextricably linked. But I'm planning to go to MozFest whether this proposal is accepted or not. I'm going to go down with the family on the Friday and Saturday and then fly to Denver on the Sunday for Moodle Moot US. So the proposal's there. And as soon as you hit send on the proposal, it puts it as a GitHub issue, as it has done for the last couple of years. And then the space wranglers, as they're known, so this particular one is in the decentralization space, can then ask you questions about it, and people can, you know, there's a community around it, etc. So I've already put a comment in there saying, please, could you have this on the Saturday if it's accepted? Because I can't actually do it on the Sunday.
Cool. Yeah, I saw.
Mm-hmm. And another one. So Seth Godin's podcast called Akimbo is fantastic, although his website is a bit confusing for it, because usually, like our podcast, we would have the audio from the podcast and then the show notes underneath it. But what he chooses to do at akimbo.link is have the podcast subscribable on Apple, Overcast, and other places in the RSS feed, and then literally provide the links in the blog post or the show notes without any link to the audio, which is weird. But that's by the by. This particular one, the one that is Series 2, Episode 5, is called Throw, Throw, Catch, Catch. Mm-hmm. So he starts off with this conceit of, I'm going to teach you how to juggle just using audio. I'm going to explain how to do it. But of course, with it being Seth Godin, he explains in a very simple way and goes on to talk about all kinds of learning in schools and elsewhere. And he gives a really nice example of, you know, why Brazilian footballers are so good, because they don't start with, let's play a match with full-size goals and full-size football pitch, but they start with, you know, like very small rooms, and it's about the number of touches you can get. And he talks about basketball and why are we asking kids to try and throw a ball, which is heavy, further than they actually can into a basketball net. And then he generalizes this into different types of learning and how we should do things. And it's just anyone who's involved in formal or informal education should listen to it. Because it just makes so much sense.
Sounds good. I'm really interested in that. I like the idea of trying to explain something, sort of putting a constraint on teaching something. It's like, right, here is the audio only. Learn this from the audio. I'm going and finding the thing that you need, the path of least resistance, I guess, which is usually finding a video, I think. People like to find videos of how things are done or whatever.
Well, he uses juggling as an example. So without spoiling the episode, he basically says that when you're learning to juggle, you're so, and I can't juggle, but you're so focused on not dropping the balls that you focus on the catching rather than the throwing. And he says, juggling is all about the throwing. It's not about the catching. The catching comes later. But if you always want to catch the balls, you'll never learn to juggle. And he uses that as an example across all different kinds of learning and how we're so focused on kind of fear of failure as opposed to providing the right constraints so that people can learn to do the thing that they should do first rather than where they're going to end up later on.
And you're right. It really is odd that he does not link to the podcast in this web page.
Yeah.
So you have to find the podcast somewhere else.
Yeah.
I just lost you then, you there?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, but I suppose it's to make you subscribe to the podcast.
I guess so, yes. I don't know. Is it really trying to manipulate behavior that much? Do you think he's come from it from that point of view?
Well, he is a marketer, so...
Yeah, maybe. Cool. I'm going to have a listen and watch those videos. They look like fun.
Yeah. Okay. And was that it? That's it from my point of view. So there's a few things I've put in here. I think there's five posts that I've written since we last spoke. There's one about advertising, one about keeping track of articles you want to read, one that seemed to get some kind of traction around introverts, collaboration, and creativity, one about busyness, and one about assassination markets. So whatever takes your fancy, really.
Mm-hmm. Let's go backwards. Assassination markets first.
I knew you'd want to talk about that.
Wow. I've been playing Assassin's Creed. I'm curious.
Of course. Okay. Okay. Have you ever heard of an assassination market before?
No, only in the way that I think kind of Silk Road, as in you could get people killed for money. But so
this is something, so the current kind of, it's interesting looking at the history of these things. A lot of the people who are not like, a lot of the original blockchain people were originally what's called cypherpunks. So in the kind of late 90s, they were looking at a new crypto utopia. And so some of the ideas that are now available and you can do through blockchain technologies were talked about in the late 90s. And one of them is prediction markets or assassination. And this in particular example is assassination market. So I've forgotten the name of the person, but he wrote like an essay or a book or something on prediction markets and how they would lead to assassination markets. So what a prediction market is, it's a bit like betting. You're just saying that you bet that Donald Trump will die before the end of the year. Yeah? And you bet, I don't know, however much money. But what you're effectively doing there is manipulating people's behavior in the real world to make that happen. So all of a sudden, if you know you can bet on a thing to happen, and it does happen, then you can clean up by either shorting that or betting on it or whatever. And there's now this prediction marketplace called Augur, AUGUR, that allows you to do this. And some of them are just very benign and like you're predicting that this will happen in the world or this won't happen in the world, etc. But of course, as soon as it involves people's lives, then you end up with some interesting scenarios. So I was just pointing this out because I think some people who are talking about blockchain technologies and talk about it from a trust point of view. But as we've talked about in this podcast before, really what you're talking about with blockchain is trustless technologies. And this is a perfect example of that.
Okay, it seems a bit weird. It says, so I'll quote from what you've quoted here. It says, the core issue stems from the fact that in addition to the pure revulsion that these markets should engender in any decent human being, they also create a financial incentive for someone to place a large bet that a public figure will be assassinated and then murder that person for profit. Consequently, the mere presence of these markets makes it more likely that these events will occur, however slim that increase may be. Wow, that's quite deviant, I'd say.
Yep, it is. I mean, I'm not sure what my or your people are listening's response to that should be, but awareness, I think it's important to be aware of these things.
No, definitely, because it's a shocking idea that that might actually happen, isn't it? Oh, well, so it's a bit weird here. I've been talking about guns quite a lot because I'm living in Idaho, where you have the right to bear arms in the street. And as Achilles said, he's seen once upon a time in the last couple of years, he saw this group of people that look like militia carrying semi-automatic weapons, and they have to be worn, you know, on in view, as it were. It's a bit weird. But he also said that crime here was, he'd not seen any at all, and he couldn't help but wonder, and he's a pacifist himself, but he couldn't help but wonder whether the guns, the fact that, so in Idaho, if someone walks onto your property without permission, you are within the law to shoot them. And he wondered whether that was something to do with why there was no crime that he had seen. I have no idea whether it was the answer that whether the answer to that is.
Well, yes. I think that's a very simplistic. I think culture is multifaceted and very complicated. So where I live in Morpeth, there's very little crime, and we don't have any guns or knives or anything like that.
Absolutely.
A lot of it's to do with checks and balances and the differences between things. There's that book that we talked a while ago, I don't know if you've read it, called The Spirit Level, about the differences between the most wealthy and least wealthy in society. And I guess this is another simplistic explanation, but you know, if you're living in a place where there's not that much difference between rich and poor, then there's less incentive to create property related or to perform property related crime, I guess. Not that there's lots of other different types of crime as well. So I think it's a bit simplistic to say that semi-automatic weapons prevent that kind of stuff. I did see that last week in Toronto there was a shooting, and they said that if the shooter had been using a semi-automatic weapon there, the death toll would have been obviously a lot higher.
Yes, I think it's no, absolutely. I don't think it's semi-automatic weapons in particular that I'm talking about. It's just that it's quite shocking that they're on display in the street. And we went to a camping shop which also sold guns, and they had the most ridiculous gun section. As you say, it's everything you would imagine it to be. Basically, the shop's called Cabela's, and how bizarre it was just to be surrounded by all of these guns. And it's a very different idea, I think, in relationship to guns than I've ever had in my life, by such a long way. It was hard to know what to make of it, to be honest.
Interesting. I don't think that people walking around carrying guns is healthy for society in any way, shape or form, and I can understand where it comes from, you know, with the American constitution, etc., but I think it's a mark of an immature society, I have to say.
Yes, I agree with you completely. I don't want guns in my life at all. I just trying to sort of feel for the mindset, you know, really. Sort of, I haven't met anyone who carries guns. and I've met quite a few people since I've been here. I don't know.
Yeah. No. Okay. Okay.
Well, anyway. Yes. Right. What's next?
Well, let's move on to introverts, collaboration, creativity, because that seemed to speak to quite a few people, and on LinkedIn and elsewhere. And this particular article was from a guy called Paul Taylor, and I came across this article via Stowe Boyd's newsletter. Stowe Boyd is an interesting guy, along with Esko Kilpie and some other people who talk about the future of work and has a long history of doing so, rather than just jumping on the latest bandwagon like I and other people do. And so in this particular article, he's talking about like myths around collaboration and whether, you know, we've talked before about the open office and that being particularly bad for any kind of concentration. But in this particular article, the guy who Stowe Boyd's referencing, which is Paul Taylor, is saying that actually classic brainstorming is not great for creativity at all, and it's based on a particular study. And I was just kind of relating that to my own work and saying that I wouldn't go as far as what this guy Paul Taylor said, and I think there's ways in which you can do things together and apart. But certainly me working as a remote worker, I feel like I can be more creative than if I had to always bounce ideas off other people who might be more conservative.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's lots of things that are interesting here to unpack, possibly to do with that, to do with if you're always working in an office where you have to be answerable to your community all of the time and you're having to interact and deliver on things. Whereas if you get clear chunks of time where you can be by yourself and get on with your work, it's usually a very beneficial thing, I think, particularly if you're fostering or nurturing a new idea. I can see what he's trying to say at that.
He says a quote here that work at MIT found that collaboration, where a bunch of people put their heads together to try and come up with innovative solutions, generally reduced creativity due to the tendency to incrementally modify known successful designs rather than explore radically different and potentially superior ones, end of quote.
Well, I think that's true, isn't it? I mean, how many good ideas have been dismissed around a meeting table because certain people just don't get them, and there's all the politics at play within a meeting, which will probably be responded to, and people, you know, ideas will get squashed. I remember somebody saying to me, actually, from my school, that he'd put forward an idea like 2 years ago, and that idea had been poo-pooed and squashed at a meeting table, and then the person who'd squashed it put the same idea forward later, and it was all green lighted, and you just thought it was hilarious, basically.
No, it's interesting, and I particularly like this quotation at the end about it says, "Once you've unearthed radical ideas from people, they need nurturing. They need protecting from groupthink meetings and committees who largely express speculated, unevidenced opinions based on current preferences from past experiences. Design thinking has a bias towards action. It resists talking yourself out of trying something radical. Creating prototypes helps you to think about your ideas in a concrete manner and get to test it before it gets dumbed down," end of quote. So this really speaks to what I'm trying to do with, you know, some of the things which we're doing with MoodleNet, like the alt profiles, the aliases, etc. Because it might be a stupid idea, but I don't want somebody in a meeting to tell me it's a stupid idea. I want some community members to tell me it's a stupid idea, or I want people to use it or not use it, or it to go horribly wrong for a very short amount of time and then us to pull it. Like, I don't want just someone's opinion to count because they're paid more than me, for example.
Yes, I think that's important as well. I think it's important also. So I think different things about it. I think the aliases idea is a good one and could serve some purposes. And then equally, I think it's possibly unnecessary to delivering the core of your product. And possibly distracting maybe from what that is, not for the user but for you in your processing and your work building, and that sort of thing, but yes, I completely get the idea that it's like, to have an idea you want it to be tested and flushed out. And I often find this when I'm doing stuff like with the digital leads and things like that, we're working as a group of people and as a team, and there's something that I particularly want them to pursue, and I think I've convince them to do so, and then I realize when I get the work back that they've done that they haven't really taken it seriously and haven't done the thing that I said and didn't really get it and didn't want to do it, you know what I mean, because they didn't have that personal motivation, they just didn't deliver. And ultimately I would have to go and do the work myself if I wanted it to be realized in any way, shape or form, and indeed tested, you know, because I think it's got have mileage and the same sort of thing you're saying about the aliens. It's you don't want it to be poo-pooed before it's had a chance to be out there in its environment being used.
Right. And I see some of this is going to be a weird analogy, but I see some of it as being like, you know, someone standing in front of someone else saying, "Hey, shall I wear this outfit to go out with?" and someone saying, well, I wouldn't wear that hat. And someone else saying, well, I don't like those shoes. And so you end up only wearing the scarf. And of course, the scarf doesn't really, you're not really pulling anything off with just wearing the scarf. You kind of have to have the whole thing to get the effect for it to be a unique outfit or whatever. And it's the same kind of thing, I think, when you're designing a system. But of course, it's a lot more complicated when you're designing a system, because sometimes if you don't design things in from the start, it'll be infinitely more difficult to then add those features in later on, like federation and other things.
Absolutely. Your analogy resonates with me, holds water. So on different occasions, I've been asked by people whether they should wear this, that, or the other, and I don't. Well, I don't think you should wear that, because for whatever reason. Because in my mind, I think I judge it to be inappropriate for whatever occasion. But in their mind, that was what they were going for. Is that kind of inappropriate thing, or that kind of thing that would be a little bit unexpected, shall we say? And because I didn't get it, they're just really annoyed that they asked my opinion in the first place.
Right, exactly.
Basically,
going back to the article, I think the author goes too far, to my mind, because he's almost saying that. I'm not sure he'd agree with this if pushed, but his article seems to suggest that the only way you can get radically new ideas and breakthroughs is by yourself. And I don't think that's necessarily true. And I give a few examples of how you can balance between the kind of, for want of a better term, like introvert mode and extrovert mode. So there's the thinkathons, which we run, where we try and include everybody and we give people a chance in a facilitated way to talk through things. There's the Google Ventures note and vote approach, which I think we've talked about before. And that's where you write down lots of different ideas and then you self-censor, and then you put your top one or two ideas on a board. Nobody knows who's or who's, and then you vote on them. It takes your ego out of them a bit.
I remember doing that one at Google, actually, with Ewan McIntosh. Mm. And working as a mentor for the Google Certified Teacher Program in 2014, maybe. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought about that, exactly that, is that, well, I put my post-its forwards and I've already filtered these. And actually, I think my idea is better than the ones that have gone forward through the note and vote method. And that's very boring, because you sort of look at other people's ideas and I kind of think, that's ridiculous. I don't want to do that. You kind of do. And it's a little bit annoying, sort of thing, whereas you have more faith in your own idea, because you get, like I was saying about the clothing, it's like the person who's coming up with the idea has some attachment to it for a reason, has some reasoning as to why it's important and blah, blah, blah.
Right, and none of these are perfect, but the last one, which I'd read about before, but had only did for the first time during that Moodle Net Design Sprint with Outlandish, is Crazy Eight. So not dissimilar, I guess, to note and vote in the sense that you fold a piece of paper so that you've got eight panes. The example that we did made it very easy, because it was like the size of a mobile phone screen, or the shape of a mobile phone screen. And you write down ideas, or ideally draw ideas in terms of like a user interface or an idea that you've got. And the facilitator gives you a certain amount of time per pane. So you've got eight, you can do it eight times, might be a minute, might be 2 minutes, whatever. Then you move on, and then again you kind of self-censor and put your best foot forward and take your best idea and then kind of riff off that. So I like the idea of having some time to yourself, spending time with your idea, having other people then be able to interrogate your idea, either if it's attached to you or separately from you, so there's no ego involved. I think that's a useful process to go through.
Yes, I agree.
Cool. Good. What else have we got? Oh, well, let me just ask you this one here. So how do you keep track? Let's say you've come across, let's say you're about to start teaching for the day, Di, and you're reading, I don't know, whatever you read, Hacker News or whatever, and you come across some articles that you want to read. How do you make sure you come back to those?
Okay, that's interesting. I'm actually quite conscious at the moment that I lose articles that I want to keep, and usually because I come across them and I should have a method of saving them, and I don't. It's sort of quite incidental, do you know what I mean? So what I tend to find is that an article will come into my life And unless I tweet it out, I lose track of it.
Right. Well, what you've said there is basically similar to me. So I feel like if I don't write about it, if I don't do something with it, then I lose it too. So it used to be I might add it to Pocket. And so this particular article, so Hacker News, like I mentioned there, this, for people who are listening who don't know what Hacker News is, imagine like a something like Reddit, something where you can submit articles, blog posts, news items, that kind of thing, and they get voted up and down and commented upon by the community. And they're often around tech-related things. And sometimes they have Ask Hacker News threads where people ask a question and people then respond. And again, people can up and vote up and down the most useful responses. And this particular one was Ask Hacker News, how do you keep track of articles you want to read? And the submitter says, when I browse Hacker News, I usually pick out a few articles I want to read from the front page, then email the links to myself to read later. This method works out pretty well for me. I'm wondering if people have other strategies that work better. The most upvoted comment at the time when I wrote this blog post was that this person had switched between Instapaper and Pocket. Interestingly, Instapaper has recently, it was sold to Pinterest and it's now bought itself back. So, and Pocket is owned by Mozilla now as well. So both useful kind of tools for deciding that you want to read something later. Instapaper, for example, integrates with Kindle. So you can send things from Instapaper to Kindle automatically. And Pocket, there's an app to do that. So I was using both of those, or have used both of those. But ultimately what I do now, instead of bookmarking really, is I add them as, so I, in the past I might have just pressed a button to say like, save this or send to Pocket or add to Instapaper, but realize that you never get back to those things. I don't know about you, Dai, I never get back to those things.
No, that's the issue, isn't it? So I'm just trying to think of how I do what I do. And it'd be like, what I really want to do is send it to somewhere I went to read every morning.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I have a reading chunk of the day, usually in the mornings, where I want my mind to be gently stared, as in climb the stairs if into thinking and into the world kind of thing, out of my slumber and my own head. And it'd be nice to have something that worked in that way.
Mm. So the only thing that I've found which consistently works is, as I've said many times before, the way that I process stuff and think about things is by writing about them. And so what I do is I've got a higher threshold, rather than like, oh yeah, I might come back to that later, therefore I'll send that to Pocket or Instapaper. Now I'll take that link and I'll put it with some kind of title in the WordPress app, because I'm going to write about it on Thought Shrapnel. So if in my dashboard, my WordPress dashboard for Thought Shrapnel, I've got 90, 100 different posts that I could write. At any given time when I've got some time to write, I'll choose something that looks interesting, read it, and then, you know, take three quotations from it and then write about it. Because to me, that's the thing which is most likely to anchor it in my mind and make it useful for my work.
No, I think it's a good idea. I mean, I do like the idea of Thought Shrapnel. It's something I thought about doing myself. So rather than actually writing full blog posts, as it were, you're just you're sharing the important parts of an article that you've read. So the thing that struck you about the article and the thoughts that have come to you thereafter. And it can kind of serve as an archive, if you like, of the web, of curation and of interesting things that might become useful later.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know everyone does things differently. So I think I'm right in saying that John Johnson, or you certainly used to do this. Hi, John, if you're listening. He would use something like Pinboard, or back in the day, Delicious, to do that. So he's just using an existing social bookmarking tool. And he would, I think, read... I suppose you could go back and update your link, but he would possibly read the article at the time and then put a quotation in the notes of that particular link.
Mm.
Then there was another guy, actually, and this was a while ago now, so I seem to remember his blog was called InfoVore. Let's see if I can find it. This was a guy who used to work for Berg in, or Tom Armitage, here we are. And he used to automatically, he's still doing it. He would automatically post his social bookmarks to his blog. And so you'd get a title, a quotation, and then tags.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Just and then you're doing the thing. I'd like to see that. The other thing I thought about, just thinking about that, is something I quite miss the principle of was Evernote, in that when you were searching using Google, you could have it so that it would also search your Evernote notes.
Oh, yeah.
Part of the response, which is obviously quite a good idea, I think. Something like that. It just kind of shows you, you want, when you search the web, you also want to search, but you also get into that place where you want to find something new. But when you're, if you have a search place that aggregates the web and indeed your own curated web, then that might actually be a good thing.
Mm. No, that's a good shout, actually. Yeah, I stopped using Evernote a few years ago, but something about being able to search and find things.
They got into all sorts of trouble, but I remember that I've not found anything that replaces that functionality quite as well. And it would mean that you're tied to using Google as a search engine, which wouldn't be a good thing necessarily as well. So, I quite like the look of this, though. So I like the idea. You just put a quote in, and you tag it and do the thing. And once you got into a system, I see he's using Ableton, which is a DAW system.
This guy has been doing this for years. Like, if you scroll to the bottom, Tom Armitage, it's infovore.org. If you scroll to the bottom where it says how he hosts it and stuff, but if you look at his archives, he's blogged every month since June 2003.
All right, yeah, bloody hell, look at that. I wonder if he ever uses it, 15 years. I wonder whether he goes back through the archives and I guess he can just go and search his blog if he's got,
He hasn't got a search function, has he? I guess every WordPress blog has search functionality if you know how to manipulate the URL, but there's no obvious...
You have archives, is it in there, maybe?
If you go into archives, you've got by keyword, by keyword.
Oh, so he's got by keyword. I can't see a search tool then. There must be one. You could probably put something in the URL and give it a search, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on. Another thing that I was writing about this week was about kind of value creation. And again, this is something from Seth Godin's Akimbo podcast. No, not from his podcast, from his blog. And he was blogging about productivity. Yeah, a lot of what Seth Godin says makes a lot of sense, you know, and he talks about, you know, he writes a blog post every day. How do you get to write a blog post every day? By deciding you're going to write a blog post every day this week, and then this month, and then whatever. And I've talked before about the Duolingo kind of having a streak, and we've talked about Snapchat streaks and other streaks before. I've now got over a month on Duolingo, so I'm very careful now to make sure I'm not going to lose my streak. And it'll be the same with blogging if I decided to blog every day. And so in this particular post, he talks about what productivity is, and he kind of just boils it down to something really simple to kind of change the way that we think about it. So I thought it was really useful.
Just reading.
Yeah, he says, productivity is the amount of useful output created for every hour of work we do. You can measure that output in money if you want to, it makes the maths easier. But in fact, it's everything from lives changed to knowledge shared. What matters is the answer to a simple question. Did I spend my day producing enough benefit for all the time invested? Yeah, so that's pretty obvious.
Uh-huh.
So then he says how the internet allows you to organize and plan your day and do things that you could never do before because you were kind of constrained to one place. But we're really bad at doing that. And the reason we're bad at doing that, he says, is because we associate busyness, with business, with an I, with productivity. So we think that looking like we're busy or just keeping ourselves doing stuff we associate that with, you know, the act of being in business, and we associate it with productivity. And he gives an example of, you know, buildings under construction, etc. And then I really like the way he finishes off. He says, busy is not your job. Busy doesn't get you what you seek. Busy isn't the point. Value creation is. And I'm just going to say something I've said many times in this podcast and said a lot of times to you, Di, which is, like, I cannot work more, really, than 4 really hard hours a day of knowledge work. And usually I work 6 hours because I'm dealing with emails and meetings and that kind of stuff. After I've done 6 hours of proper work, I am knackered and I can't do any more than that. And if I do any more of that, it has an effect on my next day. And I feel like this post kind of gets to the nub of that to some degree.
I think that's true. I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? And one of the complaints I'd have about email, one of the reasons I think people complain about email is because that's one of the things that they do that makes them think that they're busy, but doesn't make them actually be productive. And so you're only productive in the fact that you're handling an email and sort of, you know, the next step in a communication chain. But you're not necessarily actually doing anything of value creation. And I think that's an important thing to reflect upon the work you do each day, is what you do that is creating value in your life or wherever.
Yeah, and I have read, you know, the top things that make people leave jobs are, well, number one, having a bad boss seems to be the number one thing, even if you're working, even if you're earning a lot of money and working for an awesome organization. And one of the other kind of top things seems to be when you don't feel like the thing that you're doing actually matters in the world. There was an interesting thing in the eye about a guy who used to have his own advertising agency, and he had no qualms in, you know, advertising sugary drinks and fast food and all that kind of stuff until, lo and behold, he was diagnosed with diabetes, and all of a sudden he realized, oh my goodness, what I've done has had a negative effect on the world. And now he's trying to, well, either claw back some karma points or, you know, make better the things that he's done wrong by doing the opposite and raising awareness around diabetes and obesity and things like that. So, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. It's I think it's an important thing to do is to find something, a purpose that you believe in. I mean, I don't, it's quite interesting. I was talking about the investment bank last week whose profile, I guess, they don't really know their identity anymore within the organization and, you know, what they're trying to do, et cetera, et cetera. And instantly I thought, oh, well, I could really help out with you lot. I could really help explain to people who don't understand stuff how the landscape and what they need to be doing. And then I thought, wow, but I wouldn't want to. It's sort of quite exciting, the idea, when you're talking about that sort of thing of going to work for an organization, but not doing something that you believe in is soul destroying, I would thought.
Well, I think so. And there's that Mahatma Gandhi quotation, which I'm going to mangle, but it's something about, like, happiness is when you're, like, basically you're living in harmony with your values. Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said for that. So
I think so too.
Yeah. I'm going to not be able to find that quote very easily. You know, Elon was talking about Ikigai recently.
All right. Yes.
Yeah. There's a new diagram. I think actually someone like Elon or someone mentioned on the Slack channel, So for those listening, Ikigai is this Japanese conception of how to bring satisfaction, happiness, and meaning to your life. The direct translation apparently is the happiness of being busy. And so it looks at, like, what your kind of purpose, your dream job, your true vocation should be, by looking at what you're good at, what earns you money, what you love, and what the world needs. And it looks at different overlaps of those. And apparently the original diagram doesn't do a great job of that because it doesn't have the right overlap to the right thing. So this new diagram is also colorful, but it's David McCandless from Information is Beautiful. And it does a lovely job of looking at things where you've got opportunities for service or growth or finding your passion or your calling. It's really good.
I think it's worth, I mean, I think if you guys are a really useful structure in which to hang your discussions and dialogues and thoughts about what it is that you want to do. For a lot of people, I guess it's just not that easy, and they're kind of stuck in whatever it is that they are doing. But there's always, you know, you'll never regret changing sooner rather than later.
That's right. And I've used that Chinese proverb this week about, you know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time to plant it is now. And I like that as a kind of call to action.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, it'll be interesting when we go to Barcelona next week, given that Moodle's just opened an office there. It'll be some interesting conversations.
Why?
Well, you know, potential to move there, etc.
All right, okay, I see. Barcelona.
We'll see.
I've never been to Barcelona, but a friend of mine who's sadly passed away now, said he would never return to New York, but he will always want to go back to Barcelona.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and it's becoming a bit of a tech hub as well. So,
okay,
and lots of the tech companies are there, and that means obviously that the property prices are increasing. But it's a lovely place, and I don't know. Like, we keep talking about moving, so I'm not gonna say we're definitely doing anything, but I've explored the possibility internally, shall we say, and there's no barriers.
Oh, okay. It would be interesting, and I think it's also, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with Brexit, etc., but you might want to get in there before that happens.
Yeah.
If that's still possible, I don't know.
Yeah, although someone has just moved from Perth to Barcelona and got a visa very easily. Okay, let's do the last link before we wrap up. The rain is pelting down on the roof of my office at 20 to 10 on Wednesday night.
The sun is gloriously shining here at whatever the hell time it is. It's 20 to 3 on a Wednesday afternoon.
Very good, very good. Okay, this last one is tracking versus advertising. And this is just something that I came across on Nicholas Rempel's blog. Again, not someone who I particularly know, but I saw it on Hacker News. And I don't know, to some extent, you know, this is the kind of article that is useful to share with people who haven't really thought about the, the way that the web works and the way that people earn money on the web. Like, for people like you and me, and for lots of people who are listening to this, we understand that what we call advertising isn't really advertising. It's more of a highly targeted tracking system, which happens to also show you stuff to buy. And this article, I don't think goes far enough, but then might be a really useful article for some people to read if it's the first time they're thinking about it. So I'll just read the first bit maybe, and then you can read the second quotation. But he says, what we have today is not advertising. The amount of personally identifiable information companies have about their customers is absolutely perverse. Some of the world's largest companies are in the business of selling your personal information for use in advertising. This might sound innocuous, but the tracking efforts of these companies are so accurate that many people believe that Facebook listens to their conversations to serve them relevant ads. Even if it's true that the microphone is not used, the sum of all other data collected is still enough to show creepily relevant advertising. End of quote.
Okay, well, so Laurie, my host here, she had this story when I turned up a couple of weeks ago that she'd been eating Cheetos, which are a disgusting American sort of puffy crisp thing, in her office, and she never eats Cheetos. So she ate Cheetos one day, and someone had brought them in. She hadn't bought them, so they were nothing to do with her behavior. Anyway, when she goes onto Facebook in the next couple of days, she gets an ad for Cheetos. And she swears it's because her phone is listening to her, and nothing out there is no other information about it. It's too.
Yeah, so I've done some reading on this actually, and what it's more likely to be is that she is in the same office as that person, so highly likely to be connected to them on Facebook. Yeah.
Uh huh.
We know that Facebook buys up the transaction details of people who buy stuff on their cards.
And yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's all making
so sense. It's like basically saying, oh, well, if a close friend of yours or somebody who you interact with regularly on Facebook likes this thing, then the chances are you will too. So yes, it's more likely to be a bit more circuitous than listen to it on the microphone.
Yes, no, absolutely. So I thought, I really don't think that the tech companies are listening to the microphones on our phones. Mm. But I did think that there would be some connection somewhere, somehow. But all we did was really analyze her behavior, not the fact that she will be connected. She'll be on the same networks, although they don't connect their personal devices or do personal things on the school, on the office network. She works for the public service here in Idaho. Okay, so, but that does make much more sense. Right, second paragraph reads as follows. People now get most of their information from social networks, yet these networks dictate the order in which content is served to the user. Google makes the world's most popular mobile operating system, and its purpose is to drive the company's bottom line. Ad blocking is forbidden. Smart devices are everywhere, and companies are jumping over each other to put more shit in your house so they can record your movements and sell the information to advertisers. This is all a blatant abuse of privacy that is completely toxic to society.
Right, so you think, okay, great. So we've identified the problem here. So it's people tracking us, it's invasion of privacy, etc. Doesn't mention GDPR, because I guess he's based in America. And he makes three suggestions. He says, aggressively block all online adverts, don't succumb to curated feeds, and not every device needs to be smart. Now, that's great, but actually it doesn't really get to the nub of the problem. Now, you might be listening to this and you might not agree with my politics, but the problem here is not tech companies. The problem here is the logic of capitalism, yeah? Because you're trying to make money however you possibly can. And the reason that there's no particular ethical constraint on that is because you're beholden to shareholders who, by law, can demand shareholder value. I would say.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it's the baker example. You want to go to your baker. You want to get the sweetest, stickiest cake they can bake. And tech company is no different. They're trying to sustain their own interests and deliver. So they're not delivering the. So we again, we feel like we're getting the product of these companies, but we're not. And I'm not saying that we are the product, which we are. But what they're trying to do is provide information to the people who will pay them money, and that so being able to collate and curate that information accurately is huge. And that is their purpose. So I don't hold that against them, but I think it's really important that everybody is aware of the information that they're sharing and that the companies are more upfront about how that information is shared. Mm-hmm. So the Google fine that we talked about last week is really important as well. So when you look at Google giving Android as an open source piece of software, well, they're not really doing that. So to every company that signs up to use Android on their devices, they have to sign up and say you must use Google Search and you must make Google Chrome available on those handsets, and then they're in the merry dance of location data, people using Android Pay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is going on? If you look at the motivation behind all of these services, like, you know, how crazy is it to suggest that Google Earth and Google Maps are only produced to the world so that they know where you are and can analyze your behavior more accurately? It's all about driving ads at you because that's what makes 90% of Google's revenue. The biggest company in the world.
We see things as being, as I've talked about in this post, like we see things as being inevitable. So, for example, I know loads of people who have got, like, including you, Di, like, who have got Amazon Alexa or some kind of Google Home Assistant or maybe Apple HomePod or whatever. And you say, why? Why have you got that?
I can answer that question. I don't have one anymore. So I unplugged mine about 3 months ago. And because I realized that I didn't, two reasons. One, when I asked it to play music, it kept cutting out or through to my Wi-Fi. It kept just having it, you know, a half a second gap while I was listening, which was very annoying. Even if I was just listening to a Spotify playlist or something. And then I got a Philips, so I have Philips Hue lights in my main room, and I got, someone told me about a motion sensor that you could connect to the Hue hub.
Oh, and, you said this, yeah. So you can just literally walk in and does it automatically.
That's that. So, which is much more reliable than asking it to turn my lights off and it not responding at times and that kind of thing. So,
that's the thing. So I feel like people, it's a solution looking for a problem. But, you know, I was looking at a, like a card game, like, you know, I think I've mentioned before, Exploding Kittens. So Exploding Kittens is, it was funded on Kickstarter. It's not like backed by Hasbro or some huge company. So it hasn't got the economies of scale. And I was looking for an expansion pack. Anyway, long story short, if I bought the expansion pack, it would take the cost of that game up in the region of £40 for basically a family card game, which is a lot of money, right? £40. I can buy an Amazon Echo. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, how is that even possible? And it's because they're being subsidized, because actually what you're trying to get is like Kindles. You're trying to get, or Fitbit or whatever, you're trying to get the data. The data is the really important bit. And so I think that's the thing which we need to make people aware of, and that it's not... People are like, oh, well, I'm a good person and I work for the company that you're slagging off. Yeah, I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm saying that the logic for which your company kind of has to follow, because it's publicly traded. Look at Twitter, for example, when it changed to its algorithmically curated feed. It was because its numbers weren't good enough for shareholders, and it had to prove that it was getting better engagement. Like, the whole thing is driven by the incentives by which the, you know, the system responds to the incentives. That's the deal.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And it's just really important that we understand what those incentives are, and are building our technology environment, I guess, with an awareness of that. And there are certain times when obviously functionality is always going to trump, and convenience is always going to trump privacy and protection or security. But it's a good idea to be aware of what it is that, of what data you're giving up, at least in some way, and then what influence that's having on you.
But the thing I like about GDPR is that it gets around some of the kind of victim blaming, which is kind of inherent in this post. Like this post, the call to action is, well, you as a user need to do more to defend yourself. And that might be true in the current system, but I don't see why. I mean, if I'm just looking at my browser window now, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 4 different browser extensions to defend my privacy. Why should I have to do that? Like, by default, we should have a system which is incentivized to respect users' privacy. Now, I am just one user on the internet. I have some ideas about that, how you might be able to do that, but it's not really my job to do that. And I think that the GDPR is a good step towards it. But we need to be thinking more about thinking on behalf of users rather than every user on the internet having to do some kind of crazy self-defense.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. It's and I think that's why the GDPR ruling on Google is such a big deal, you know, and you can only go one step at a time, I think. We'll see. Anyway, it's interesting. Barely, in the meantime, people do need to have an awareness. And they do need to educate themselves about what it is exactly that they're doing and how they're spending their time and how it's coming to them. On the other hand, I'm sure a lot of people just say, look, I get all these services for free. They're cool. I really enjoy them. Screw the world. And I guess a lot of people have that mindset.
Well, if you remember a few years ago on Tide, we talked about how privacy would end up being the preserve of the wealthy, basically. And we're almost there. Like, the only company that claims to differentiate itself on privacy is Apple, and Apple devices are much more expensive than other devices.
Yes, absolutely. I saw a thing actually, I don't know if it's relevant particularly, but Huawei have taken over Apple as the greatest manufacturer of handheld devices in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is that because they sell so many in China? Or?
Oh, well, I think it's their move into the Western markets that are actually become a big deal. I've seen so many more Huawei phones recently, sort of things. So they're just sort of coming up into the sort of LG, Samsung area of the market, I guess. And
I didn't see somewhere, it was in one of the papers, either the Guardian or the Eye, saying that, you know, the cheapest iPhone X is £1,000 or whatever, £1,000. And it was saying like you don't need that, especially if you're for teenagers. And it mentioned Huawei phones and saying like they were £129 or whatever, and did everything you need.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So it's really interesting, isn't it? So if I was manufacturing mobile phones right now, I think smartphones, is I would identify some really core key functionality and deliver that at a high standard for much less money. That's the way I'd sort of get around it, rather than having, so if you ever see how a mobile phone is made, it's really, really interesting sort of manufacturing process. And obviously thousands of people employed by these companies. And one person's job is to, they say, right, our price point is going to be this, and we want to fit this, all these different sensors in, and this memory, and you know, whatever, these chips, whatever. And the person has to find space in the hardware and deliver it on cost as well. And it's a really sort of fascinating thing. But I think every time I see a sort of cheaper phone, the OnePlus range are an exception to this. But every time you see a cheaper phone, you're sacrificing quality of something or other.
Interestingly, that article said that the OnePlus 6, the newest released OnePlus device, was the best value for money in terms of the features you get. Yes, it's £400 odd. But in terms of the features you get and the functionality, it was the best value for money. It's an interesting thing to do. We talked about Nintendo before. I was reading an article earlier today which was saying that the genius of Nintendo is that it tries to, instead of thinking like Sony or Microsoft in terms of, okay, well, we're making a new games console and it's going to have to be future-proof because this is going to be the console for the next 5 years, like the PlayStation 4 or 5 or whatever. The genius about Nintendo, they said, was that they focus on now, what's useful right now. Sometimes they get it wrong, like the Wii U, but like the Switch, they were saying, is perfect for mobile gaming. Some things it doesn't do, but then those right now, we don't need those things. And it was talking about like just getting into the market and doing the right thing right now, which I thought was insightful.
Yes, no, I think that's really, really important. I think you can see that in different tech products when they're successful. Do the right thing at the right time and do it damn well. And people will back your product because it's just a bell curve of uptake, isn't it? You know, So if you're making sure that you're hitting something at the right point in the bell curve, you're going to have something that's going to gain a lot of traction and be very successful. And then by the time you're dipping on the bell curve, you're reiterating anyway to what is now. And that principle is something. When we talked about displays last week, you mentioned saying buying smaller and cheaper is so much better, and which I agree with in regarding tech, is because like when you buy a new computer, I'm like, well, buy one that's cheaper and then replace it in 2 years' time. Don't spend £1,000 when you can spend £400 and have it for much shorter time, because the technology will improve so much in that same amount of time and
it's
come
not,
down.
It's not so awesome for the environment, but yeah, I think that you're better off in terms of value for money.
No, but these machines can be sent on if you're, that's another conversation.
No, absolutely. No, but I stand by what I said last week. Yeah, I agree.
Cool. I just had a really odd thing happen. Okay, so I was on Instagram this morning and do you remember me talking about my last school? I worked with a gentleman called Graham Hobson, who is CTO of Photobox and Moonpic.
Right.
He was a governor at my school, a parent governor.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So I used to deal with him. It was a fantastic opportunity to deal with someone with such digital experience. And anyway, so it moved on. That was 4 years ago. So he was on, he's on holiday in America with his family. And he put this thing up saying, "Hello, Boise," this morning. What? Okay, coffee? and And so he's just responded now and he's moving on. But weirdly, he's going from Boise to Le Grand, where I'm going on Monday. On Monday to see my cousin, where I went the other week as well. And so he's going to the same two places where I'm being in America. But I'm not there.
You're stalking him.
Yeah, well, he's just on his journey. He's off to Portland, so we won't cross paths.
Yeah, okay.
That's all.
Okay, so what have you got planned? You've still got another couple of weeks there, is that right?
I leave a week on Monday, so I have plenty of time. This weekend, I'm in a cider microbrewery on Friday night doing there's some live music going on. And then I'm out on the town in central Boise on Saturday, out on the river in Boise on Sunday. And then on Monday, I'm going to head up to Le Grand and to see my cousin and her children for a couple of nights, and then back down here. And then we're off camping on Friday to Lake Cascade, which is very, very beautiful, apparently. I'm very excited about that. And then the Monday after that, I head home.
Very cool. Mm. Well, we're not going to be able to record a podcast for a while because I'm going on holiday next Tuesday on the 7th. Flying to Barcelona, staying in a hotel and an apartment there, going on the train because we're getting Interrail passes to Lyon in France. And then we're going to Zurich, getting the sleeper to Ljubljana in Slovenia, staying there for quite a while because we're going to go around Lake Bled and do some kind of outdoors activities. Get the train to Austria, to Salzburg, and stay in there, Big B. And then we are going to, I think, either Augsburg or Munich, and then going on to Stuttgart and then flying back.
Cool. That could be incredibly exciting. I saw the weather report for France. Someone put it, because it was it was between 34 and 38 across the country. So every different spot, except for one, I think it was, across the entirety of France, every little temperature sensor, as it were, was at these really high things on the weather. Those was plastered in them. So it could well be hot in Europe. So I recommend getting little fans for your children or something. Something that's going to keep them.
I just tell them to go in the shower with their clothes on at the start of the day, have a cold shower, let them progressively dry over the course of the day.
That's it. We'll have a good time. I can just see you dripping onto the train.
Are you sure this is going to work? Yes, shut up, keep walking.
I look like I've wet myself. We'll have a fantastic time. I hope it's really awesome.
Thank you. Yes, so back at the end of August, and I'll tell you all about what went right, what went wrong. Hopefully it'll be more of the former than the latter.
Cool. I look forward to it. An adventure nonetheless.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening to this, everybody. This has been Tide 106. Until next time.
Take care. Bye-bye. At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.